Hi, everyone. Can I ask you to take your seats, please? Thank you. Welcome to the session on a house or a home, finding value in Australian residential properties. This is obviously a very interesting area post-GFC with a number of different points of views. But before I introduce the speaker today, a few housekeeping rules. Can I ask you to turn off your phones, obviously? In terms of questions after the presentation, to step up to the mic, introduce yourself, and a two-minute limit on the questions and comments. In terms of the format of the session today, Anthony will take us through his presentation, which is approximately 40 minutes to 45 minutes, and then 15 minutes for discussion at the end. And then please complete the feedback forms. So it's my pleasure to present Anthony Street. He has over 18 years of experience across a range of investment and financial services companies. Most recently, Anthony spent 8 years in Macquarie Funds Group as product manager for a range of Australian global equity products, and for the last 5 years was head of product management for the Macquarie Real Estate Securities team and a joint portfolio manager covering Australian-listed REITs. He's actually got a very long list of accomplishments, but his latest accomplishments is that Anthony is currently in the middle of a period of non-paid employment, looking after his children and carrying out value enhancements to the investment on which he is spending the most time, which is his home or his house. Not sure. So, Anthony?
Well, thanks very much, Annie, and afternoon, and thanks, everyone, for coming along. I'm doing my best not to spend too much time on the house, given my my handyman skills, so instead I thought I'd do something useful, like write an actuarial paper. Well, I guess it is a sort of actuarial paper, obviously. Residential property isn't your sort of traditional area that you see at these conventions, but I guess I first started getting a little bit interested in it around the middle of last year, and we started to get a whole heap of broker reports coming out talking about the Australian residential market, and then all the banks coming out with their points of view. And it was interesting seeing the different sort of arguments they use and the different bits of data and the sort of, I guess, manipulation of data, if you like, to get their point of view across. And, of course, being actuaries, you wouldn't see actuaries manipulating data or assumptions to get a desired result. But I thought it's interesting to see how the property industry has been doing it recently. So that's sort of mainly what I'm going to cover in this presentation, those sort of different arguments that are being used, and also just touch a little bit about residential property from an investment perspective and see if there's any value in residential property for an investor. And, of course, obviously there's hundreds of views and many, many different views on this topic. So, more than happy to discuss alternative views at the end of the presentation. So just to give a bit of a snapshot on what we've seen, this is a graph of real house pricing index in Australia over the past 50 years. And you can see over the 40 years from the 1960s to the 1990s, really, there wasn't a lot happening in Australian house prices. A little bit up, a little bit down, and in the end, sort of fairly modest growth over that period. And then it was really from 1999 when we just saw house prices take off in Australia. And over that period, by my calculations, the real house prices went up about 6% per annum. And, that was just far in excess of anything else, like GDP growth, rental growth, population growth, or even share market returns. And so, where we are now has obviously raised the question as well, is this a bubble, or is there some kind of fundamental backing to where the prices are? And I thought an interesting way of looking at it is maybe look at some of the quotes that we've seen over the past 12 months from various individuals and groups on what they think about this question of is it a bubble. And the first one was from Glenn Stevens, who appeared on Sunrise about 12 months ago, and I'm sure there's probably a few Sunrise fans in the audience here, and you would have seen Glenn Stevens chatting to Koshy about one of his main concerns was the amount of debt people were taking on to invest in housing, and his real concern that people just thought borrowing money, buying houses was a surefire way to make money. And so he was really cautioning against that. And he was also sort of lamenting with Koshy that his kids and Koshy's kids weren't going to be able to afford to buy houses in Australia because prices were just getting too high. And then a few months after that, we had Jeremy Grantham, who's the co-founder of GMO and their chief investment strategist. he came out and said that Australian house prices are twice as high as they should be. And yeah, this got a fair bit of press over here. And really, it was actually part of a bigger global study that he was doing on bubbles, across all sorts of asset classes, equities, commodities, bonds. And so he was trying to identify investment bubbles because it's a good way to make money. If you think something's at the top of a bubble, you can sell it and you can make a lot of money from it. So he'd identified 34 different bubbles across the years, across all sorts of asset classes. And of those 34 bubbles, he thought only two hadn't bust and returned to its long-term trend levels, and that was UK and Australian house prices. And so that generated quite a bit of interest, especially in the investment community. And so a lot of fund managers and hedge funds started looking at this issue and thinking, well, can we... is there a way we can short the Australian housing market, in effect short the banks? And so all the brokers came out with their reports on it. And this is one quote from Jared Minnack, the chief economist at Morgan Stanley. And he did quite a good paper, I thought, on it, covering quite a range of different factors. And his conclusion was that Australian house prices are expensive on every value metric, and they're expensive relative to history and are relative to comparable countries. So it was pretty sort of a definitive conclusion that, yes, we were in the midst of a bubble. And then just a few weeks ago, David Murray, the Future Fund Chairman and ex-head of CBA, also came out and said Australian house prices are uncomfortably high versus the rest of the world. But then, of course, in the face of all this talk about a bubble, the banks obviously have a pretty significant vested interest in the residential market, given their residential loan books. And so they all came out with reports as well, trying to explain why it's not a bubble and why there is fundamental justification for the current prices. And so CBA's view was taking into account geographic differences. So essentially, if you look at capital city house prices, where the majority of Australians live, then prices aren't actually as high as they are in comparable countries. And Westpac similarly suggested that the housing affordability isn't as stretched as some would suggest. And they also talk about this issue of a structural imbalance between supply and demand. And this is something that you hear a lot about as well, this sort of chronic undersupply that we've got in Australia, basically being caused by high immigration levels, high population growth, and lack of supply through sort of weak new constructions of dwellings. And so we'll have a look at that a bit later. And then ANZ took a slightly different view. So they sort of accept that the price-to-income ratio is higher than it's been over the past 10 years, but their view is that there's been a structural and permanent reduction in interest rates. And this is, again, it's a common theme that the interest rates that we saw in the 70s and 80s we're just never going to see again, because the RBA now has inflation targeting and they've been very successful in keeping inflation down and therefore interest rates down, and therefore we're never going to go back to that 10% plus interest rate environment, and therefore house prices will stay at the level that they are at the moment. And so I guess it's it's an interesting school of thought. And then finally, we come back to Glenn Stevens, who only a few weeks ago was giving a speech in London. And as part of the Q&A for that, he was asked a question about whether he's worried about house prices. And now he's saying, well, the house price-to-income ratio, it's higher than it used to be, but it's not exceptional by a global standard. And so this was quite an interesting comment, because it was really only 12 months ago he was so worried about house prices to want to appear with Koshy and explain his case, and now a year later he's not worried at all. And so it was sort of a pretty curious comment, I thought, and so it's a little bit of an aside, but I just thought it's worth looking at, well, what concerns Glenn Stevens and what is concerning the RBA. And I think if you look at what house prices were doing in March 2010 when he appeared on Sunrise, you can see it was, there was some pretty strong growth coming through. And over the previous 12 months, house prices had grown 18%. And really, that's, it's a pretty clearly unsustainable pace of growth for house prices. And so he really wanted to get out there and try and slow the market down, because he also knew that interest rate tightenings were coming. And we can see what's happened the following 12 months is that house prices have flattened. And really, that's, as far as the RBA is concerned, that's a pretty ideal situation for them. They don't want to see house prices collapse because of the, you know, the potential impact on economic activity and the rest of it. But to see, you know, flat growth is something that I think is, I think the RBA is quite happy with. And so I think Glenn Stevens' comments, well, I'll talk a little bit after this about the whole concept of the price, house price to income ratio, but I think more importantly, it's not so much the level that I think they're worried about, but the direction that house prices are going in. So coming back to this this concept of the house price to income ratio, you can see in the quotes that I showed, it's one of those ratios that's talked about a lot. You know, almost everybody that talks about house prices refers to this price to income ratio. But why is it that half the people say, well, it shows that Australian house prices are inflated, and the other half say it shows that house prices are in line with other countries? And it really comes down to the different measures you can put in the house price and different measures you can use for income. And so there's one school of thought that you use a median dwelling price. So this is a bit hard to read. This is from Rismark, who calculate a median total dwelling price across Australia, so not just houses, but houses and units and across all markets. And then they divide it by the average income. And this is where I think there is a bit of confusion with these ratios, is working out exactly what household income is. I mean, it seems like a pretty simple measure, but there actually isn't a survey of household income out there. The ABS does a survey every couple of years, and the latest available information is from 2007-2008. And so the people that use this kind of ratio argue, well, you can get more up-to-date income information by using the national accounts information, which comes out every quarter. And so what they do to get this ratio is they take the total national income from those numbers and divide it by the total number of households, and so they get an average income ratio. But of course, when you think about taking the national accounts information, it means you're including all the income of all the small percentage of the population earning a lot of money and dividing it across the whole population. So it does inflate that household income figure quite a bit compared to taking a median income level. And then also the national accounts information, it does have this component in it of imputed rent on owner-occupied dwellings. And so that, again, inflates it against what would actually be considered a normal sort of, you know, actual income level of households. And so that's where you get this four to 4.5 times ratio that you see quoted quite a bit, you know, particularly by the banks. But you can alternatively calculate it in another way by using, you can look just at capital city house prices. And so this is the data that the ABS provides. So the ABS only looks at capital city house prices. So quite often you see ratios just based on that. And then also you can work out a rough median income ratio. So you take the median income from the ABS numbers from a couple of years ago. And, you know, I guess you can sort of assume that the composition of income earners per household doesn't change that much, so you can sort of inflate it with, you know, wages growth and other things to get a rough approximation. And so that's where you get this, you know, 6-7 times ratio, or the 7.5 times ratio that Jeremy Grantham quoted. And you can see from the graphs, there's actually not too much difference between them. I mean, they both show that house prices now are twice as expensive, you know, essentially twice as expensive as they were 10 years ago. They both really have the same sort of pattern. I mean, the only problem is when the ratios, the actual number, say 6 versus 4, is compared, and there's no actual discussion of the fact that there's different numbers have gone into it, and there's different use of whether it's a median or an average income in the denominator. And more importantly, it's when those numbers get compared against other countries without actually checking that exactly the same methodology has been used for those overseas countries' ratios. And so a very good example of that came from the CBA. So this is the report that I quoted on earlier. So this came out in September 2010. And so, as I said, the CBA's view is that house prices, when you look at capital cities in Australia, aren't that different to other countries. And so they quoted this, had this table of house price to income ratios, and, you know, you can see there Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane versus those other cities, and, you know, they don't look too expensive. But then if you have a sort of a closer look at the source there, which I've made it a little bit larger, and normally people sort of ignore the source when you look at these kind of tables, but this was an interesting one because they've sourced Demographia, which is a group that comes out every year with a survey of house price to income ratios across various different countries, and invariably Australia always comes out as the most expensive. So this year they came out with Sydney was the second most expensive city to Hong Kong. The year before, Sydney was the second most expensive city to Vancouver. So it's interesting that CBA have used this data but somehow shown that Australia isn't more expensive. But then you notice the second source there of UBS, which happens to be CBA's friendly investment banker, have obviously helped out with the data somewhat. And so it's not, you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to sort of go to the Demographia report and see what have they taken from there and what have they got UBS to recalculate. And, surprise, surprise, it's the Australian numbers that they've recalculated and recalculated to be substantially lower than the Demographia report. And the Demographia report is based on median house price divided by median income. So it's pretty clear that they use the same ratio across all the countries. And so when you look at the difference there that have been calculated, well, sort of the conclusion is that obviously they've recalculated it using average income for Australia, and they've got the lower ratio there using that method. And then when you look at it on a total level, they also provide the house prices across the whole of Australia. And again, so this is sort of the argument that CBA and the banks have, that Australian house price to income ratio isn't that different to other countries. But again, you can compare that to the actual Demographia report, which compares it on a like for like basis. And you can see for Australia, it's significantly less. And you can see the 4.3 is in that 4 to 4.5 range that we talked about earlier, which is calculated using an average income, whereas the Demographia is calculated using a median income. And so you can see it's really, it's basically just been calculated on a different basis. And now I thought, before I said this, I should check with CBA just to see if my understanding was correct. And I did get put in touch with the author of the report, and he admitted he calculated the Australian numbers on using the national accounts information and calculated on it using an average income number for the denominator. And so when I did sort of question, do you think calculating the Australian number using average income and comparing it to other countries that have a median income, that maybe it's not a like-for-like measure? And his response was, well, you're an actuary, so you understand that kind of stuff, but none of the clients I took it to noticed anything. So, it was a pretty surprising response, and mainly because nobody's complimented me on being an actuary for a very, very long time. But I think that's really... And to be fair, the clients he's talking about are the hedge fund and fund manager clients that he took this presentation out to tell them why not to short CBA stock. And to be fair to them, there's no reason why they would pick up that difference. It's basically presented like in the... Well, they presented it like in the table here. They just said a price-to-income ratio. They didn't explain the basis of it. They didn't show anything to say that the Australian calculation was different from the other countries. So there's really, there's no reason really to think that there would be a different methodology. And this is part of the problem, is that you now have all the banks saying this, that Australian house prices are in line with other countries. You get all their investment bankers saying, you get somebody like Glenn Stevens who, I'm not sure if he's got his own data. I haven't seen RBA do a proper analysis of this, and really it was an off-the-cuff remark that he made in a Q&A session, and quite easily he could have said it because he's seen numbers like this. And so that's how you get this sort of, a bit of a myth sort of perpetuated that, that house prices in Australia are in line with other countries, but my view is they are actually quite inflated. But I guess that's really... That's really just one measure of house prices, is this price to income ratio. So there's various other things that can be looked at. And so the other one is supply, and that's really the other probably the main argument used by the property industry to explain why house prices are high, and that there's this chronic shortage of houses at the moment. And this is a chart that I reproduced from a Stockland presentation. So Stockland are an ASX-listed company. They're one of the largest residential land developers in Australia. And so like CBA, they like to keep their investors happy about the state of the Australian housing market. And so this is a chart showing annual dwelling starts versus population growth. And when you look at the chart, you think, dwelling starts did roughly keep in line with population growth, and then over the past 5 years, population growth just took off due to the higher immigration levels, and supply just hasn't really caught up, and therefore we're in this period of undersupply, which they argue is going to continue for a long, long time. But one of the things I found when I was trying to reproduce this data, because it's all just from ABS data, which is pretty easy to get, was the scale of the left-hand axis, and that maybe a more appropriate scale is to actually look at, well, how many houses do we actually need for this kind of population growth? And the ratio of people to dwellings in Australia at the moment is around 2-1. Sorry, it was around 2.5-1. So for every 250,000 more people we have, we need 100,000 dwellings. And so when you change the left-hand axis to reflect that scale, it's something quite remarkably different in that effectively there's been plenty of houses being built for the population growth we've had over the past 10 or 15 years. And really it only was sort of a 1 or 2 year period where we had this spike in immigration where perhaps there was a little bit of a shortage. But you can see the population growth's already come off. Dwelling starts has already picked up. And even just last week, some other numbers came out which showed immigration's already fallen 100,000 from that peak there. And so the growth over the past 12 months in population was 350,000. And so for 350,000 more people, we need 140,000 more homes. And you can see we're easily covering that. And over the past 12 months, it was actually 170,000 new dwelling starts. So, this whole argument about supply is just, based on the numbers I've seen, it's just a bit hard to justify. Now, the IMF, I sort of quite like this concept of using graphs to show the result you wanted to show. And the IMF also came out with a report sort of towards the end of last year. And so I don't know if you've read my paper, but it's actually not very technical at all. But the IMF paper does take a bit more of a quanti approach, and they use an econometric model to come up with an equilibrium level of house prices for Australia. And anyway, the end result of that model was that they believed house prices in Australia were only 10% overvalued. And remarkably, when you look at a number of their graphs that they show, they also seem to paint that picture that Australian house prices are just slightly overvalued. And so this is a similar one showing population growth or population versus house prices. And you can see the trend line between those two factors do seem to be pretty similar. We've had strong population growth and house prices have kept pace with that. But again, you can see with the axis, they've started house prices at zero, but they've started population at 8. And so you sort of think, well, maybe if you show them both from zero, again, it's a pretty different result that you get, in that house prices and population were roughly neck and neck, but only up until 1999, when Australian house prices just took off compared to a total population. And this is the other thing you can look at when talking about supply is if there's been this chronic undersupply, then surely rents should have been impacted by just as much as house prices. And really, we haven't seen that. There was a 1 or 2 year sort of spike in rental growth, but it's basically already come off. So there just doesn't seem to be the continued pressure on rents that you would think would be there if we were having this ongoing undersupply. And also the other thing is just to look at the level of rents there. I mean, a lot of people compare Australian house prices to Asian house prices and say, well, a lot of the Asian cities are really expensive. But then you look at the rental growth they get up there in Hong Kong and Singapore, and they get 15-20% rental growth in a year without anybody being overly concerned. And last year in Hong Kong they had 20% rental growth over 2010 in Hong Kong. And we just never have anything close to that in Australia, and that's one of the concerns, is that we're getting these huge price increases without any sort of fundamental backing, which you'd get if you were getting that sort of strong rental growth coming through. Another thing that that gets looked at is mortgage affordability, and this is another graph I took from Stockland's presentation. And so their argument is, well, mortgage repayments as a percentage of gross income, if it's around 35%, so this is looking at a median dwelling price divided by median income, and if it's around 35%, that's okay. And so because we've had low interest rates, you know, it's been around 35%, so it's not a major issue. But you sort of think about, well, 35% of gross income, so you've still got to take tax and living expenses off it. It is a pretty high level. And you know, I found something from the US that Barack Obama introduced a Making Home Affordability Plan, which basically said people that were under mortgage stress could apply for mortgage relief. So effectively a low interest rate, extend the term of their loan, that kind of thing. And basically people that could apply for that was anybody that had anybody that was paying more than 31% of their income in mortgage could apply for mortgage relief. And so if you think of 31% is a level, then, you know, clearly where most people are, most people buying homes would be above that level at the moment. And also to note, this is based on the median dwelling price, which at the moment is around $420,000. So if you did this number based on capital city house prices, which is, you know, over $500,000, then clearly, you know, you can see why buying a house in a capital city in Australia is just, yeah, it's unaffordable for the majority of Australians. Dwelling size, another argument, which I think has some merit, is that we're now building bigger homes and therefore people should pay more for them. And I think that's a reasonable argument, but when you look at the sizes, dwelling sizes are around 15 to 20% more than they were 10 years ago. So, you know, maybe that does account for 15 to 20% of the price increase. But, you know, given we've seen 100% or more price increases over the past 10 years, it obviously doesn't cover the full extent of things. The other thing to look at is household debt. And this is the thing that really worries a lot of people, is that households have just been borrowing more and more money to pay more and more for their houses, and that's what basically, well, one of the reasons that we've seen the inflated house prices. Yeah, and the concern is that if the house prices have been growing simply because people have been borrowing more money, then, you know, again, there's no real fundamental backing for it, and if something goes wrong with the economy or whatever, then any house price correction is just even worse because it's been built up by increased leverage. And so what do I think are the main factors causing the house prices to be where they are at the moment? And I think it's unemployment and interest rates. Now, since 1999, it's really been one of the first periods in Australia since the early 1970s where we've had, you know, pretty consistently low interest rates and unemployment. And really that's what's enabled people to just simply to be able to pay more for their homes, been able to borrow more and pay more. And even though we went through the GFC, you know, there was a little hiccup, but really, you know, because the employment market in Australia just stayed so strong, house prices were able to be maintained and even recover. And so this was a quote that I saw from Jeremy Grantham in his talk about bubbles, and not just Australian housing market, but all sorts of bubbles, is when you have a strong, ideally nearly perfect economy and generous money, you are nearly certain to have a bubble form. And really, that's what we've had in Australia over the past 10 years. We've had pretty much, I guess, a perfect economy in Australia, you know, obviously helped by commodities and China and the rest of it. And we've had banks willing to lend a lot of money to households at fairly cheap rates. And, yeah, I think the end result of that is that you've potentially had a bubble form in house prices. So that's sort of the main sort of arguments that people use. And I thought another good way of looking at or trying to find value in Australian house prices is looking at it from an investment perspective and saying, well, you know, is there any investment value in buying a home? And I've got some props here. Because if you read the media, obviously, now is a fantastic time to buy residential property. And this is one I found from the Sun Herald. So this was from 20th of February, their investor magazine. We have a pulse. Why it's the right time to get back into property. And so this was a pretty big, you know, double-page spread of talking about why to invest in property and, you know, some of the quotes from it. The lights have turned green and nobody is moving. Each of the big banks has produced research reports debunking the likelihood of a crash or even a serious correction. And the mother of all rental squeezes is approaching, especially in Sydney. The next 3 years will be sensational for investors. So, you know, it's pretty... they're pretty definitive that it's a good time to invest. And it's funny, it actually also happened to appear on the same day that their 2010 property guide came out, which was a very, very lengthy and colourful document with various... a large number of half-page colour ads from every single property developer that I think has ever set foot in New South Wales. And I'm sure they're all very, very grateful that there happened to be an article talking up the residential property market on the same day that they had their expensive ads in there. And then just in a similar vein, I just did a quick Google on residential property investment to see what would come up, and there were a few interesting quotes. 8 out of 10 millionaires made their fortune in real estate. It's the best way to build wealth and secure your financial future. Why should this was an interesting one. There were a few other more serious factors, but one of the things that they mentioned was banks will lend up to 95% on property and only 60% on shares. So there you go. You don't even need to use your own money to invest in property. Housing shortage leaves high demand for rentals. Invest now. And this was from a university, so it must be true. And you can even send away for the DVD, which I was very tempted to, but I couldn't really trust that man with my email address or phone number, so I thought I'd better not. And then this is an interesting one from Rismark, who are now 50% owned by my ex-employer, and they're trying to market residential property to institutional investors. And so this was a view that if the resources story unwinds, then obviously the economy will go through a difficult period, but the RBA will reduce interest rates, and as we know, interest rates are good for housing, and therefore the housing market is a powerful hedge against Australia's resources boom running off the rails. So, it's a bit of an interesting thought on it. I mean, I would have thought if the resources boom ran off the rails, there'd be a pretty big spike in unemployment and probably a share market collapse, which, wouldn't be great for house prices, but I guess that's an alternative view. So what do we get when we look at how residential property stacks up as an investment? And I'm actually not going to go into the numbers in too much detail. They're in the paper if you want to have a look at it, but it's pretty intuitive because at the moment we've got gross yields of less than 5%, and that means you've got net yields of less than 3%, and that's before interest. And clearly, if you're then borrowing money and paying a mortgage rate of above 7% and getting less than 3% income, obviously you're not making any money from it from an income perspective. And clearly, it all comes down to investors are just betting on continued house price appreciation of 5% or more in order to make it worthwhile. And I guess a lot of people think we will still keep getting 5% house price appreciation, and I guess that's why they keep investing. But one thing I just did want to look at is this concept of because we've got this undersupply, it doesn't really matter what price, it doesn't really matter that you're paying a high price now, because even if you don't get capital growth, rental growth is going to come through and it'll make it all worthwhile. But really, given how low yields are at the moment, I just did a quick calculation. House price growth falls to 3% per annum, so still not too bad, keeping pace with inflation, you'd actually need rental growth of 13% per annum for 10 years just to break even, or for a geared taxpayer just to break even. And you can see from the other chart, the highest rental growth we've ever had in Australia is 8%. So to get 13% per annum over 10 years is... it's pretty much just impossible, really. And then what have investors actually been experiencing? Well, this is based on ATO data, and 83% of salary and wage earners with an investment property reported an income loss. So pretty much everybody, every wage and salary earner that owns a property has been losing money on it from an income perspective, and largely because a lot of them are using gearing. Well, pretty much everybody is using gearing for it. Now, this is just something I delved into in a little bit more detail was the ATO data. You know, I've obviously had too much time on my hands when I start looking at ATO data. And they split all their numbers by occupation. So you can have a look at, well, which occupations are actually making money from investing in property. And there are a few. There's not many. There's probably about half a dozen out of 200 occupations that are making that on the whole are making money. And so you can see it's investment income recipients, super funds, property operators, financial asset investing. So I think the concept here is that I think if you set out to make an income gain out of property, you can do it by investing in higher yielding properties, not necessarily residential, and not overly gearing. And you can see it's really only around 50% of those investors use gearing. And then I had a further look down the list, and it was actually interesting that the next best investors were farmers, and even mushroom growers get up there in the top 15, and then gamblers. Gamblers are in the top quartile of property investors. And then it's really a long, long way down to salary and wage earners, which make up 60% of all taxpayers, and only 17% of salary and wage earners are making an income gain on their property. And you can see that, and they're just using a massive amount of gearing, and that's one of the reasons why they are. So owner-occupiers, we're only going to touch on it briefly, and the main reason is you know, essentially the majority of dwellings in Australia are owned by owner-occupiers. You know, 70% are owned by owner-occupiers. And as you'd all know, you know, the decision to buy a house isn't purely financial. You look at a whole host of, you know, social and personal reasons. And, you know, I mentioned there the economics of happiness and this school of thought that the people make investment decisions, you know, not purely just based on wealth and income, but based on, you know, quality of life. And that's really what you see in the housing market. But the end result of that is that from an investment perspective, you are going to get an inefficient market. You know, it's going to go through boom and bust periods like any inefficient market. But in Australia, we've just had this 10-year boom period, and I think it's made a lot of people complacent that, you know, that we're never going to see the bust. But, you know, inevitably, at some point, we will. And then just a couple of slides on the US. I'm not going to go into too much detail. Everyone pretty much knows about the whole subprime thing and how that led to the US house prices falling. But you can really see that strong divergence between what happened in the US and what's happened in Australia. And one of the things I did want to point out is the different unemployment rates. And you can really see how, you know, the main reason the US housing market is struggling to rebound is because of the high unemployment rates there. But you can see the Australian unemployment rate just continues to go down. Even just a couple of days ago, it's fallen even further to 4.9%. And that really is the main thing that's propping up the market. And, you know, people talk about bubbles busting, and I guess my point of view is that, you know, I can't really see a major bust happening when, you know, when we've got such strong unemployment, because people can afford to buy houses and they can afford to borrow money. And so until we see that unemployment rate tick up, it's probably unlikely we'll see a major correction. And so that's the summary. You know, interest rates and unemployment are the key, and I believe those factors far outweigh a lot of the structural arguments that many people in the market use. And before we turn it over to questions, I just thought I'd leave just one quote with you from October 2006, which was said at the peak of the housing market. And it's always fun to pick on these people in hindsight that make these quotes and turn out to be terribly wrong. And so this one was, the US housing market largely reflects a strong US economy, and the US housing market has never declined. And so any guesses as to who said that? Close, very close. His successor, Ben Bernanke, chairman of the US Federal Reserve. So that's really it. So any questions or comments or alternative views, I'd be happy to discuss.
Thanks for that, Anthony. If you've got any questions or comments, please come up to the mic and just say your name. Just whilst everyone's thinking about that, I wanted to get a show of hands as to who was actually looking to buy an investment property before this session. No? Who's actually looking to buy an investment property now?
I'm the one to sell, right?
I had one. I saw the index before earlier where you were showing the property price index, which obviously with significant growth, and in June 2010 it flattened out slightly. Do you have any theories around why that happened? Yes.
Yeah, well, that was basically when the RBA started tightening interest rates again post the GFC, and that was a point that I made in the paper, is that, you know, we're seeing fairly modest increases in interest rates and mortgage rates, and at the moment mortgages are probably, you know, around about an average level. But despite that, and despite obviously a still very, very strong economy, we've seen houses flatline. And I think the reason for that is because they had just reached a pretty much unaffordable level. And it's not actually going to take a lot to see house prices tip over a little bit, because we've already seen, you know, small increases in interest rates flatline growth, and if we did see further increases in interest rates or even a tick up in unemployment, then you've got to sort of think house prices would start to come off then.
Mike Murphy from Mayon Hewitt. Just looking at the quote up there, actually, and trying to find anything that's wrong with it. That perhaps in 2006 there was a strong US economy and the housing market was reflecting that, and possibly it's factually correct that at that time the housing market has never actually declined. So he wasn't actually making a comment about the prospects of the future. Perhaps other people just interpreted it that way.
Yeah, it could be.
Bruce Thompson from Thompson Actuarial, and my disclosure statement says that I spent most of last year selling two houses and buying one bigger one. You've disappointed me, though. I figured that I was paying about 10 to 20% too much for the house, but I think the answer seems to be about 30. The big thing, other than location, location and location, that we were looking at last year was, okay, we can't find what we want. Do we buy something and knock it down and rebuild? And so we spent a fair bit of time looking at the difference between the price of the land and the price of the house, and what the profit margin of a developer is, and all those sorts of things, in 5 minutes with a spreadsheet, of course. Your paper there doesn't talk specifically about land. It does talk a bit about house prices increasing and that being a factor, but my reading of your paper would be that it is land that is severely overpriced more so than houses. Is that where you're thinking?
Yeah, well, I guess, yeah, I suppose I haven't looked at it in too much detail, but, you know, I think it's essentially it is pretty much land. I mean, I think, there's obviously certain costs that go into building a house, and I think given the whole market's been inflated, it's probably allowed builders and developers to charge more for the construction as well. So it's possible that is a little bit inflated as well. But I've got to admit I haven't really looked in detail at that, but I would think it's mainly just land and. Especially with, obviously, when looking at houses, you know, certain locations that people want to live in, and living in capital cities, and that's one of the main reasons it's inflated capital city prices relative to regional prices in Australia.
Dennis Barton, Barton Consultancy. Anthony, you haven't mentioned anything about either the US government's efforts to encourage the market leading to the GFC in the end. And also the other side of that, the Australian government's efforts with, I think they're called NRATs or something like that. Have you got any comments on those?
Sorry, what was the first part of the question?
Well, the US government, there is a school of thought that there's a particular event to do with housing affordability that triggered the upward boom in, or the boom in the US and then securitisation and then everything else followed from that.
Mm.
So that's one thing. But that leads on to my question really is the Australian government's efforts in boosting the price of housing.
Yeah. Well, I think the things I've been reading is that there's a lot of the housing boom in the US was caused by the extremely low interest rates that they had there, with Alan Greenspan, and those low interest rates enabled people to borrow more and more for their houses like they have in Australia. And so I think housing affordability in Australia also gets a bit of discussion as well about various measures that the government can use, and obviously the first homeowners grant gets quite a bit of coverage as well, and I haven't sort of covered it in detail here, but there's arguments from a lot of people that those first homeowner grants purely just caused house prices to continue increasing by the amount of the grant, and I think that's part of the problem the government has with strategies like that, is that it's not those kind of first homeowner grants aren't necessarily just to make homes more affordable. They're to try and increase economic activity, and by getting people to buy and sell homes, it actually increases broader economic activity, which is why they do that. But it has the offsetting effect of making houses more unaffordable. In terms of the other strategies, I mean, they don't seem to be doing a lot. There's some things on there's some rental. Rental sort of assistance packages, and there's grants that developers can get if they make affordable housing. They can get some grants, and there's certain things on capping the levels of rent and things like that. But there doesn't seem to be a lot going on by the government to make houses more affordable.
Alex Gould from PwC. That was a fantastic presentation. My question is, so what do you load up on cash, fine wine? What are you going to invest in?
It's a good question. I suppose if you think house prices are going to continue growing 10% per annum, then you can invest in houses. I think just the point is that it is quite inflated, and you have to... And also, I guess it's important to pick and choose what properties you invest in. I mean, if you can get a 6-7% yield from an investment property, then you may actually do okay. And some of the numbers I did in the paper reflected that. But if you're going to get a yield of 4-4.5%, then clearly you're probably going to struggle to make money. And a lot of the comparison I did in the paper was just compared to a term deposit, and getting a 6%. Term deposit, you obviously don't get much capital growth, but it's a reasonable return compared to the amount you could potentially lose by investing in residential property.
Hi, I'm Kevin Lin from Common Shop. First of all, thanks for a very good presentation. My question is on... I found the international comparisons very interesting here. I'd just like to question the definition of housing prices there. Because as you know, like places in Hong Kong or Singapore, they live in much smaller dwellings. I'd just like to know what would happen with the comparison if we change the definition of housing prices to something like a dollar per square meter approach.
I suppose there's a couple of ways you could look at that. There still is, I guess the main measure people look at is just median house prices, and so they just look at the average house prices over whichever country you're looking at. So I guess it probably does adjust for that a little bit. I suppose the other way of looking at it, and it's one study that was mentioned a couple of weeks ago, and I haven't actually read the article, but it was something The Economist did, and they came out saying Australian house prices were inflated because they were looking at house price to rent ratio, So that's a good way of allowing for that comparison of, you know, different size houses by looking at houses compared to the rent that people are paying to live in them. And so, so on that basis, it should allow for that different sort of compositional sort of difference between different countries. But that report, again, came out that Australian house prices were expensive on that basis as well.
Aaron Fry from Manulife Financial. All investment decisions should be made on an after-tax basis. So has there any work been done on... is the reason Australia seems to be overpriced based on the statistics that you've been putting up because Australia's giving better tax deductions or compared to other countries?
No, there's... there's the negative gearing that we have in Australia, which we don't have in other countries, obviously has... You know, it's argued it has some impact, and I think that's one of the reasons why you see a large number of wage and salary earners quite happy to be earning an income loss on their investment property because they've got this negative gearing, which means they can get a tax offset for it, and this concept that, you know, we're getting something back from the tax man, therefore we don't really need to worry that we're not making any money on our investment property, and in the long term house prices are going to continue rising, so we'll make money out of it from that perspective. So yeah, there is a school of thought that the negative gearing in Australia has contributed to the house prices going up.
I'm Robin Knight from OnePath. I guess there is a development of new property indices going on. I believe ResMart has done one, Sydney University, which are either hedonic indices that are reflecting the characteristics of properties or repeat sales. Certainly in the US and the UK, these are widely used. I think we'll see these coming in the next few years. In terms of your comment on the RBA, my understanding is that they do a huge amount of fundamental analysis, so that this is probably their number one concern. I think if you talk about regional versus inner cities, I've no idea why somebody would buy an investment property in the inner city. I certainly sold one last year. I think if you look at parts of Queensland, some of them haven't seen any property growth since 2003. So I think there are enormous regional variations. I think even in Sydney and Melbourne, if you look at the inner ring, the outer ring, and so forth, they vary quite a bit.
Yeah, no, I agree with all that. And those hedonic indices are being used. So the RP Data Rismark Index, which has been around for a few years, does use that. And the ABS Index as well, they adjusted their methodology in 2005 to allow for the sort of compositional differences that you get in houses that are sold from year to year. So the median house price data that you get out there now actually is pretty good quality.
One last question from me. Given the potential risk of the bubble bursting, obviously, what do you think the government should be doing now? Obviously, big repercussions if it blew up. But
I think that's what the RBA is really focused on, and that's why they started increasing interest rates, because, you know, they could see that a bubble was forming, and I guess it's all in all likelihood that they will keep sort of ratcheting up interest rates a little bit, assuming the Australian economy keeps going strongly. And but, you know, I guess that's a sort of a fairly blunt instrument, and there's not a lot they can do to really prevent it if sentiment does change and, you know, people do start just selling houses and no one's buying. And, you know, obviously that's the risk you get with, you know, these kind of markets, that you can get those things driving it, and there's possibly not a lot the government can do. But, you know, the RBA does seem to be doing a pretty good job in, you know, trying not to let these bubbles be formed or get into too serious a level where a crash is inevitable.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Anthony. That was a great presentation. Join me in applause.